We're going to start out today, and I worked with each of the three faculty individually. We recorded presentations for all three of them on these three topics. We'll let you know when everything's posted, and you can check out their presentations which go through these topics in detail. But what we did for tonight is just pick out a few of the slides that were presented just so we can capsulize it and then really move on to the issue of how this functions in terms of clinical practice. And we're going to integrate a survey we just did in the last week or so with 50 general medical oncologists in community-based practice. And maybe we can just kind of start out with that, and maybe just to take a step back before we start talking about scenarios. Dan, maybe we can just talk a little bit about M0 disease. In your lecture, you went through the data. We'll talk about that in a second. But just maybe provide a little bit of a broad perspective, Dan, on where we've come from in terms of M0 disease, where we were 3 or 4 years ago, where we are today, and where you see us moving in the future, Dan.
So previously, there was really no standard of care for treatments with M0 prostate cancer. We often tried secondary hormonal manipulations, but there was no FDA-approved treatment. So Matt Smith, a number of years ago, looked at zoledronic acid. He did a retrospective analysis of those patients and found that those patients who had a PSA of greater than 13 and who had a rapid PSA doubling time were the ones who got into trouble the quickest. And about half of those patients from his study developed metastatic disease within 2 years. So the endpoint of metastasis-free survival, which was the endpoint of the apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide trials, was used for FDA drug approval. And whereas we had no drugs in the past for this indication, now we have three.
So let's talk a little bit about how this is actually playing out in practice. And Chris, you can see this question we ask the panel of 50 oncologists, a 65-year-old patient, has a prostatectomy, PSA only, recurrence, and further progression after, I think, radiation therapy, now with a PSA of 3.4, a doubling time of 10 months. And you can see that there's the docs in this survey are using anti-androgens. I don't know how exactly, whether it's 100% representative of what's going on in the United States in terms of the choice. But Chris, any thoughts about these answers?
In all honesty, I suspect that might be driven by having a more active marketing project out there for the use of apalutamide. In this situation, it's approved now for this non-metastatic CRPC setting and hormone-sensitive, so people may be interested in trying out a new drug. We know enzalutamide very well from its use in castration-resistant disease. I'm a little bit surprised about darolutamide. That may be a lack of familiarity, because in all honesty, I would be interested to hear if Rob and Dan agree. All three drugs have the same efficacy. They both delay the time to PSA progression, the time to appearance of disease on a scan, and also the side effect profile is possibly less with darolutamide in terms of less fatigue. 10% of patients have trouble with apalutamide or enzalutamide from fatigue and cognitive changes, which we don't see with darolutamide.
Rob, any comments on that? You know, general medical oncology is an incredible challenge nowadays. And we're trying to do CME. We can barely keep up with everything going. It's not that easy to keep up nowadays. It looks like the perception in the general medical oncology community is that the efficacy is about the same in terms of tolerability. It's interesting. People have sort of different impressions. I don't know whether they get them clinically or from the data. What's your approach to this situation, Rob, in terms of choice of agent?
As my colleagues have said, I mean, the data is the same. If you look at all three papers and you just look at them by themselves without comparison, the bottom line is the darolutamide trial suggested that in the placebo arm, there was not a lot of difference. That's not the case with the other two agents. Therefore, for me, if I'm going to treat a patient in this clinical setting based on level one evidence and my interpretation of the toxicity, darolutamide is what I would use. Abiraterone, despite the fact that it may have utility here, has not been tested here, nor is it approved.
So we're going to dig a little more deeply into this, but we'll also get into some cases. And here's a question that we want to pose to the audience to answer. And this is really based on a case that Dan presented in his session where he recorded his presentation. He presented two cases that we're going to show today. But we just want to know from the audience, if you have an 84-year-old patient who's got a history of atrial fibrillation, sick sinus syndrome, pacemaker, and hypertension, and you're going to use hormonal therapy, any preferences as to which one? And while they're sort of thinking about that, in a second we'll look at the case. But Chris, how would you answer that question? Any preferences in terms of choice of agent in this situation?
The first question would be to ask, does he need anything? What's his rate of rise? Because his chance of dying from his comorbidities is substantial. The other issue is dollars to donuts. He's probably taking an anticoagulant, maybe a DOAC, with drug-drug interaction issues. So I would have to be hard-pressed to actually start anything. And if I were to start, it would probably be darolutamide for the less of the cognitive issues, less drug-drug interaction, less frailty-inducing if he needed a therapy.
So, Dan, this actually was based on a case that you presented in your individual session. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with this man? He actually had M0 disease. What happened with him?
So, basically, we started him on enzalutamide. He's doing fine right now, had a PSA decline. Interestingly, we did try darolutamide first, but we were denied by the insurance company because they wanted us to try enzalutamide first. Their line was, quote-unquote, he had to fail enzalutamide before going on Dara. So he's not on an anticoagulant. At this point, he does have sick sinus syndrome. He's got a pacemaker in place. So he's not on any anticoagulant, at least when he came to my care.
That's interesting, though. Putting aside the cardiovascular history, so you had them deny darolutamide for M0 disease. And here we're talking about, you know, what your preference is, and yet it sounds like you weren't able to actually execute that. How's he been doing on the enzalutamide?
He's doing fine. He's doing fine right now.
Great. So, Dan, when you went through the data, I love this slide that you put together. Can you comment a little bit on it?
So basically what it's showing us, it's comparing apples to bananas. The structure of enzalutamide, in fact, enzalutamide and apalutamide came out of the same laboratory. They're very, very similar. There's a variation on the ring on middle ring, pretty much it's the same otherwise. If you look at darolutamide, it's structurally very, very different than the two, and that may account for the reason that we have a different distribution in the central nervous system crossing the blood-brain barrier with these drugs. Apalutamide, 19%, enzalutamide, 29%, whereas darolutamide has only a 3% penetration rate. So that, I think, is a very interesting observation. It may explain some of the toxicities that we've seen.
Anything you want to say about the trial? We've been looking at these for a while now. You put together the first two. Anything you want to say about the data there, Dan?
They're very similar in their hazard ratios as well as their medians. I think what's striking is the control arms are very, very similar as well. So you really can't tell the difference between these two.
Same what about the Aramis study?
Same thing with Aramis. Very similar hazard ratios.
And here's maybe a comparison of the three. Anything you want to say about this, Dan?
Again, the hazard ratios for overall survival at this point are the same. The estimated survivals, there is a difference at this point in median overall survival. But again, this is estimated. And we now have close to 4 to 5 years of follow-up in these patients.
And here's where it gets really interesting. And you put this together, comparing the toxicities, Dan.
Again, enzalutamide has higher rates of fatigue, falling, dizziness, and mental impairment than darolutamide does. And certainly this could be a differentiating factor between these drugs.
So, Rob, can you comment a little bit more about sort of, you know, it's one thing to look at clinical trial data and see, try to the evaluation of toxicity, but what you actually see in your clinical practice? And maybe talk a little bit about what's been called fatigue, but maybe is more of a central nervous system syndrome that you see with these agents.
Yeah, you know, all of us have used these drugs a lot. And what you see is there's fatigue, and then the patients who complain of, you know, I forgot how to get home. But the fall and fracture rates are surrogates for this. Patients who lose their balance and have fractures. And as our patients get older and the sarcopenia that's associated with some of these therapies, those are real issues. So to me, when those of us who know this data, we look at the fall and fracture rate as a true surrogate of harm for the cognitive issues. And in the darolutamide trial, you see less of that. And since, you know, our patients are 60, 70, 80 years old, this is a real issue.
Chris, any comments on that? And again, in terms of clinically in your experience, what you see with patients, and this is not just an issue in M0 disease, obviously, but can you talk a little bit more about, again, this sort of syndrome of, quote, fatigue that you see in the pathophysiology of it?
Two things, yes. So there's obviously, it would appear to be something crossing the blood-brain barrier. Interestingly enough, we know the drug enzalutamide and apalutamide were both designed off the back of benzodiazepine-like structures. So there is some GABA reactions. And we know they also have this rare incidence of seizure. So there's some pathophysiology and molecular biology that makes sense. Interestingly enough, I've just saw some data hot off the press today. We've presented the results of the quality of life from the Enzamet study. And the specific question I've asked is, how many patients on enzalutamide have a 10% drop? Some people have a mild drop in their quality of life and their fatigue and their cognition, but it is actually 10% who have a clinically significant decline, which plays out as a subtle overall impairment for everyone as a group, but it's a 10% who drive that subtle difference between placebo versus drug.
It's really interesting. And also, I never heard about the connection to benzodiazepine. That's really interesting. So Dan has another case that gets into a different issue in terms of M0 disease that we haven't really talked about as much. But the more I listen to Dan talk about this case, the more I realize how important it is. And to get into that, we have another question that we want to put out to the audience here, which is, what systemic treatment, if any, would you add on to an LHRH agonist in a 74-year-old man with M0 disease who has disease progression but still negative imaging while receiving enzalutamide? So as a patient with castrate-resistant disease, M0, gets enzalutamide, responds to it, but now the PSA is going back up, but still no evidence of metastatic disease. And we'll see how the audience in general thinks that through. Rob, any comment in general about this sort of space, so to speak? How do, in general, the audience is split between not adding anything, not doing anything, and then maybe trying another form of hormonal therapy? 20% of people say docetaxel in the M0 setting, which I don't know about that. But Rob, any comments?
One of the things that worries me and my colleagues is that we're treating patients. Remember, some of these patients got hormonal therapy for biochemical failure who may not have needed hormonal therapy. So if you treat enough of those patients, you're going to make castrate-resistant PSA-only disease. And then if you treat them, they're going to progress. So here's a guy who, you know, probably conventional imaging, maybe if you use next-generation imaging, you find disease. I think we need to be thoughtful about how much we treat a parameter PSA and how much we're treating, you know, the underlying disease and how much we're treating ourselves. I think there's a real danger to that. This is a data-free zone, and I think we just need to be careful about this.
Well, let's see how this plays out in real life with Dan's patient, a 74-year-old man. And so Dan, he presented, I guess, initially in 2007. Can you talk a little bit about this case, Dan?
So he had a radical prostatectomy at that time. He had T2CN0 disease. I'll go on to the next slide. He started to have a rise in PSA in 2013. I couldn't treat him with salvage radiation therapy at that time due to the fact he had severe incontinence. And we monitored him until his PSA went up to 12, and he wanted to start hormone therapy at that point. So we started Degarelix, and he was treated intermittently, basically for the next 4 years. And his PSA started doubling rapidly early in 2018. We put him back on androgen blockade at that point. his PSA was 18, and he did not respond to androgen blockade at that point. His testosterone was 20. So we imaged him. He was negative, and he went on enzalutamide when his PSA reached 26. And his PSA doubling time at that point was 8 months. And his PSA nadired at 4 in October of 2018. And then January of 2019, it started rising again. We imaged him again, found nothing. Actually, we think we imaged him twice during the next 8 or 9 months. And both of those imagings were negative. But he was concerned about his PSA rise. And he reached 71 in December. And he said, look, I don't want to continue on with enzalutamide. Through the VA, we're able to get him apalutamide, and his PSA continued to rise. Reached about 240 in February of 2020, and we reimaged him at that point again. He had, at that point, he had metastatic disease in bone, and he's on docetaxel. He's actually responding very, very nicely at this point.
And you told me that he actually was becoming symptomatic with pain, and that responded nicely. So, Rob, I know you're very conservative about managing these patients. You already mentioned that. But when I look at this case, I go, you know, if you think about it, you know, in December, he was clearly progressing. A lot of the audience suggested trying another hormone. I'm curious to know, Rob, whether you think that has any possibility of benefiting. But then 3 months later, he was on the docetaxel, and then he's symptomatic. So, I mean, if you want to do Monday morning quarterbacking, I'd say maybe it would have been better to start the docetaxel earlier. But, of course, I don't think we have the data. But just in general, Rob, any comments about this scenario?
I think this is a case that, in a year maybe when we have PSMA PET more broadly available, Dr. Petrylak would have, he knew that the patient had metastatic disease. He just couldn't prove it, right? So it'll move leftward where we are, especially in a patient like this. And this wasn't the patient I was really referring to. It's more of a patient that, may have a very prolonged PSA doubling time, and it's more about chasing numbers as opposed to bad disease biology.
So again, would you use a second hormonal therapy, Rob, in this situation? What would you do in that situation? Again, looking in retrospect at December.
There obviously is no right answer, and, I probably wouldn't have been inclined to do so because I would have thought that the cross resistance to the drugs was such that there'd be a problem. As Dr. Petrylak, I know, did is he was telling the patient, look, you probably have, we would now say we might find oligometastatic disease at some point with these patients. So I think this is the kind of patient whose management is going to change a fair amount over the next bit because of just better imaging.
That's really interesting. Looking for oligometastatic disease, that maybe you'd be able to treat locally, I guess. Chris, any thoughts about this scenario? Have you ever seen a response in a patient who's progressing on one antiandrogen to the next one? How do you manage these patients?
There are two thoughts on that. One is I would start with encouraging this patient, saying, yes, your PSA is going up, and we're going to watch this closely, not necessarily need to change from an amide to an amide, but we will watch you and we'll do scans and we will switch therapy when we need to. The PSA is telling us we need to watch you more closely and try and engage them in that and to try and address their fears that way. The second issue is I have seen patients respond well to an amide after abiraterone. And that's a patient who's been on abiraterone for 2 years, 3 years, lymph node only, you switch them over, they get another 18 months on the amide. I've not seen patients really benefit from amide to abiraterone. So the hormone switch does work in a minority of patients who have got good, long, durable responses to abiraterone in some of them. So you can try a switch, but you've got to watch them closely, knowing when to change them over. And one of the questions in the chat is about ARV7. We know who are the ARV7 patients without testing. They're the ones with rapid progression, newly progressive disease on an amide. The patients who have a slow progression on abiraterone, lymph node slightly larger, PSA going up, they're ARV7 negative. So I use clinical parameters rather than ARV7 testing.